For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about something closer to home, but something that is really, it just sounds more like science fiction the more you talk about it. And that is using biological techniques, biology, to build microelectronic devices to use, well, we can make tiny computers out of them and build them up into big computers. Some scientists have been exploring ways to use the knowledge and tools of microbiology, and I mean DNA splicing, gene manipulation, the tricks of protein folding, to build such things as microscopic wires and tiny transistors. And if we really need to make really tiny electronic devices, why not let DNA do it? Why not? This area of designing germs to build transistors and other components is on the cutting edge of science, and for the rest of the hour, we'll be talking with some of the pioneers in this field. And if you'd like to talk about it, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Angela Belcher is the John Chipman Associate Professor of Material Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in Cambridge. She's one of the authors of a paper out this week in the journal Science that explores using genetically engineered viruses to form the basis of nanoscale wires, using viruses to make tiny wires. And she joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Uri Sivan is a professor in the Department of Physics at the Technion, Israel's Institute of Technology, that's in Haifa, Israel. And in November, he and his colleagues published a paper in which they described assembling a transistor from DNA and carbon nanotubes. And he joins us by phone from Israel. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
Thank you. Eric Winfrey is an assistant professor of computer science and of computation and neural systems at Caltech in Pasadena. He and his group there study how systems of biomolecules, such as DNA and enzymes, can process information and carry out algorithms. And he joins us from KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Angela, in a recent issue of the IEEE Journal, I think it was November issue, you were quoted as predicting last July that within 6 months your laboratory at MIT would have a virus that would build a transistor. How close are you to that?
Actually, we're really close. Today, a paper came out in Science where we were evolving organisms to build the basic components for of semiconductors and semiconductor wires. And in the that IEEE article talked about being able to genetically manipulate three different parts of a virus simultaneously to start building devices.
Uri Sivan, did you actually make a transistor?
Yes, we made a transistor with a different strategy using a recombination process.
And you made it. How easy is it to get DNA to make a transistor for you?
Well, you know, it takes about 4 or 5 years to develop the process, but once you have it, it's pretty easy. Today we do it within one day.
Tell us how the DNA, how does it work? How does it build it?
All right, we use the DNA We use DNA molecules as a template, really, to template the assembly of this electronic device. It turns out that DNA and its related proteins can indeed build remarkable structures, but as far as electronic functionality, they don't have any electronic functionality. They are pretty good insulators. So our strategy is to use DNA and those related proteins and engineer them in such a way that they will assemble non-biological materials for us. And those non-biological materials are the materials that have the electronic functionality. So in that science paper which you mentioned, we have been using recombination process, which are, I mean, the most well-known recombination process in nature are probably chromosome crossover. You know, when two chromosomes are crossed over and form two new combination of chromosomes, which are the childs out of the mothers and the fathers. Now, it turns out that this is really a fantastic mechanism, and you can use it with only slight variations to take whatever molecular object you like, not necessarily biological one, and put them on whatever address you would like on a DNA template. So we were using that to pick up a carbon nanotube, which is a non-biological material that can serve as a transistor and localize it on a DNA template. And then in the second step, we use that template to grow conductive wires connecting the nanotube. So that's, in very short, that's the principle.
Wow, fascinating. Eric Winfrey, he and his group are studying how systems of DNA and enzymes can process material and carry out algorithms. I want to get to you, but we have to take a short break, Eric. So hang in there and let everybody hang in there together. We're going to take a short break. Maybe we have a little bit of time, Eric. Do these actually do computations for you?
Well, what we're looking at is computation that occurs during the sort of biochemical processing, sort of the way life works. It's a chemical system. It doesn't. In many cases, it doesn't use electronic signals to do its information processing. So we're looking at how molecules, just in the way they interact with each other, carry out algorithms. One such algorithm might be how to fabricate or build a complex pattern, which might be maybe the template for an electronic circuit that could be generated by the techniques that we just heard about from Angela and Uri.
All right, we're going to talk more with Angela Belcher, Uri Sivan, and Eric Winfrey. Don't go away. We'll take your questions about using biology to create electronic devices. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about using biology for future generations of electronic devices and computing. My guests are Angela Belcher of MIT, Uri Sivan of the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology, and Eric Winfrey of Caltech. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Eric Winfrey, let's talk a little bit more about how a piece of DNA can contain information. I mean, tell us about how it could be a sort of a crude computer there.
Well, containing information is something that biology does very naturally. DNA is made out of the different bases, A, T, C, and G. And they can be strung together in an arbitrary sequence. I guess one of the important things is, sort of from an engineering point of view, is that that information doesn't have to be biological information. It doesn't have to code for a protein or some other biological purpose. You can, as an engineer, choose any sequence you want and synthesize it using synthetic chemistry, get your own piece of DNA. And that means that sort of all the different chemical functions that DNA is capable of are available to you as an engineering tool. So one of the purposes that we use DNA for is we use a sequence sort of as in a code for telling one molecule whether it should stick to another molecule or not. And our research program, a large part of it involves designing DNA molecules that self-assemble into extended structures directed by these codes.
And are these structures the transistors themselves, or the wires, or any electronic parts?
At this point, they're not components, but they could potentially in the future serve as scaffolds or templates for arranging components into a particular pattern that you were interested in.
Because Uri Sivan was talking about his DNA does act as like the backbone for the transistor he made. Could that work be imported into your kind of lab?
There's certainly potential there, yes.
Angela Belcher, tell us about how it was fascinating to read about how you use viruses, how you genetically engineer viruses called phages to create the wires. On your website you have a cute little animation that shows with complete with music how you do this. Tell us the steps how you turn a virus into a wire-producing object.
What we're doing is mimicking nature, like how an abalone grows calcium carbonate to grow a shell. We're using viruses to be able to grow any kind of material we're interested in, and one kind of material are semiconductor materials. And so just like in nature, how organisms have evolved over millions of years to be able to use these, we force about a billion different viruses to interact with the semiconductor material and live with it and basically make a copy, an imprint of what its surface looks like. And then that imprint that is protein-based is actually coded within its DNA. And then we have the virus. We take a billion viruses and allow them to interact with a semiconductor material, and then only keep a couple of them that that interact very well, and we throw the rest of them away. And anyone that does interact, we keep evolving it to have better and better interaction, and then we can have that basically saved as genetic information, and then we can make billions and billions of viruses that can now grow that particular semiconductor wire.
So you basically breed the viruses for ones that can make the wire better.
That's right. We go through and take a billion possibilities, and we breed them to make a wire that we're interested in.
So the wire, the one end of the virus attaches itself to the metallic, let's say the node of something you want to use to create your wire, and the other end attaches it to the other side?
Well, that's right. We can actually manipulate many different proteins and many different genes on a single virus. And so we can have one end of a virus grow one kind of material and another end of a virus grow or attach to another kind of material all through this genetic selection and amplification.
So the virus might bind on one end to gold and the other end onto the wafer of a transistor, and then so that you got the backbone there.
That's right. We can get it to bind between two different materials, mm-hmm. and then what we do is we pour in precursors and grow a wire. It could be a metal wire or a semiconductor wire or a magnetic wire, just by throwing in precursor salts.
So like zinc salts of zinc, and then it lines itself up along the length of the virus there?
Well, it actually grows. We can control the growth a couple atoms at a time. So we have not only the right material, but all the right orientation, the right size, that has all the properties that we like.
And so then once it's grown, you don't need that original virus anymore.
It depends on what the application is. We can either burn off the virus at that point just by increasing the temperature, or we can keep the virus around and recycle it and use it again.
Uri Sivan, you use DNA as templates, and then you have the DNA attract the little carbon nanotubes to create the transistor. What is there about the DNA that, you know, which is, I guess, sort of a living, we think of as a biologically active piece? What is there about it that can attract something inert like a carbon nanotube and make it line up to create the kinds of wires you need?
All right. Well, the process involves more than just the DNA. The DNA itself provides addresses. And then the real active element there is a recombinant protein called RecA, a protein taken from E. coli bacteria. And in nature, it does the following remarkable thing. If you have double-stranded DNA with certain sequence of bases, like Eric was describing, and you take a piece of single-stranded DNA, which is homologous, or let's say identical to a given segment out of this long double-stranded DNA, and then you introduce the RecA protein, which you introduced in the form of monomers, and it turns out that the RecA polymerizes very quickly on the single-stranded DNA and forms some kind of a fiber, a complex fiber. And then that fiber has a very clever search algorithm. It searches in the whole solution for segments on the double-stranded DNA that have identical sequence. Once it finds the sequence, it binds there, and then it does a remarkable thing. It starts to displace one of the strands of the double-stranded DNA and replaces it with the identical strand it brought from home. Now, it turns out that you can use that really as a fantastic molecular assembler, because you can synthesize whatever sequence you like, just where you would like to, same address as the address where you would like to have your transistor. And then you can attach to the single-stranded DNA whatever material you would like, I mean, biological or non-biological, and the RecA will search in the whole bank of the double-stranded DNA for the identical address, and will place there the single-stranded DNA together with the object that you attach to that. Now, we use this mechanism basically to localize the carbon nanotube. What we do, we have a DNA template, and we decide that we'd like to have a transistor at a given address, given sequence. So we synthesize the single-stranded DNA with the same sequence, and we let it search in the solution. In solution, we let it search the right address, and then it binds there. Then we take in a different tube. We take the carbon nanotube, which is, of course, does not have any molecular recognition, and we react it with some protein called streptavidin, which just binds non-specifically to the carbon nanotube. Then we use antibodies, which on one hand recognize DIRA-K on the double-stranded DNA, and on the other hand, they have some group that recognizes streptavidin and therefore binds to the streptavidin-coated nanotube. So just by virtue of molecular recognition by this antibody, it localizes the nanotube, which is a non-biological molecule, at the right address on the double-stranded DNA molecule. Once it's localized, we use some metallization process we have developed. We have developed a number of years ago a metallization process by which we can coat DNA specifically. So metal grows only on DNA. Now, it turns out that the same RAC-K also protects that segment where the transistor is against metallization. So metal grows along the DNA template and contacts the nanotube, which was placed there by molecular recognition. And the last step is just we just dip a silicon wafer in solution, we pull it out, and we have zillions of those transistors on the silicon wafer, and they can be gated. They just act as conventional semiconducting field effect transistors.
Wow. So how many can you create at once?
Pardon?
How many can you create at once?
Oh, I don't know, tens of thousands or perhaps more than that. I mean, we can't image as many as we make.
Angela Belcher, why not? Why use viruses? Why not use bacteria or whole cells themselves to create the stuff?
We actually use many different organisms, and we've been focusing on viruses because viruses have this nice shape. The they're very long and thin. But we've also been using other organisms like yeast and to grow materials as well. So any kind of organism that you can easily manipulate in the lab and that will make copies of itself relatively quickly and has proteins that that are expressed on a surface are good components to use. So it depends on what the particular application is. We look at a lot of other applications besides growing semiconductor materials, and for certain kinds of materials, it's advantageous to use different kinds of organisms.
Mm-hmm. Eric, let me talk to you about your DNA and your enzyme work. How efficient is DNA so far in calculating computations, and how does it compare to modern electronics?
Well, I think the main difference is what kind of computation do you want to perform. Our electronic computers are particularly good at sort of raw abstract information processing. They're also prevalent for sort of electromechanical control devices. You find CPUs in your automobile engine, your toaster oven, and so forth. And so what we're really trying to do is learn how to control biochemical processes in the same way, where you can program the feedback loop and the circuitry that sort of directs what the biochemistry does. So it's a very different application in that sense. Although one of the applications is control biochemistry so as to grow a useful circuit. For example, the viruses themselves have protein subunits that assemble into these virus capsids that Angelo's using, and that's in some sense a form of programming that evolution has come up with.
1-800. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So. One of the primary things that we're exploring is how to program DNA to self-assemble into complex patterns, mm-hmm. patterns that we intended. And to some extent, I guess the metaphor I like to use is it's like making jigsaw puzzles. If you have a bunch of jigsaw puzzle pieces, they each have a little sort of shape on the side, and two pieces will only fit with fit together if their sides match properly. And in the biological context, if you have a bunch of these sort of, think of molecules as jigsaw puzzle pieces, they're constantly shaking up, bouncing around, but when they find another tile or jigsaw puzzle piece that fits, they'll stick together. And so actually you'd have a self-assembling jigsaw puzzle. And so we're trying to do this by designing DNA molecules that fit together sort of into two-dimensional structures in a similar way.
Talking about using biology to do electronics this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Peter in Side Lake, Minnesota. Hi, Peter.
Oh, good morning. I mean, good afternoon, Ira. Thanks for taking
the
call.
Yes.
I have a question that was raised in a recent essay by Arthur C. Clarke. And he was writing about the course of our human biological evolution and the evolution of our computer information robotic technology. And, of course, a perfect example of which we have sitting on Mars as we speak. And the premise of his essay was that we, as we advance in the fields of computer technology, and certainly that includes your topic today, that we will eventually create our own replacements, and that that is, at some time, there will be this sort of human-machine hybrid that is the, sort of the next step on the human evolutionary scale. And I understand that this biological computer technology is in its nascent stages, but I guess I'd like your guests to comment. One, is Arthur C. Clarke's premise totally crazy, or are they taking the first steps in that direction?
Eric, what do you think?
Oh, thank you. I think if you look historically, like very historically, this has happened to life quite a few times. You originally had single-celled organisms that, you know, were their own independent units, and over time they started putting themselves together into societies, organisms, and in some sense lost their independence.
Are you talking like the mitochondria in our cells were once bacteria? And now they're...
That's certainly an example, but just the first multicellular organisms themselves were cases where you had previously single-celled organisms. Uh-huh. Now you have a single cell in a multicellular organism. You know, think about a cell on your fingertip. It's not doesn't have too much choice about what it does. So this process happens as life changes in, you know, geological scales, and it seems quite plausible. I don't know how long from now that you know, human life will also reorganize itself into either sort of societies to some extent do this. But
let me get another. Angela, you agree with that? It's inevitable.
Well, if you look at the example of using viruses to work with kinds of materials, we're in making them work with materials they normally wouldn't work with, but they're also materials that they normally wouldn't have in the environment. So what I think is that in the case of, say, the zinc sulfide or the cad sulfide, that the viruses could have used them as a material building block instead of making something like shells out of calcium carbonate or calcium phosphate like bones, but they didn't have the opportunity to interact with them. And so these organisms are interacting with these materials in much higher concentrations than you would normally find out in the world, and they're going to work with them, you know, given the opportunity in their environment.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Any fear that these might escape out of the laboratory? I like that, in Prey, that book Prey, and because they're getting self-replicate, and, you know, we talk about nanotechnology now, people are very fearful of that. What do you say to that, Yuri?
Well, I don't think that this is really something to worry about. But if I may, I would like to comment on the previous question. I mean, it's a very important question. You see, in everything we are doing up till now, although it looks as some kind of integration between biology and man-made materials, there is still, I mean, the integration is still not full in the sense that we use biological molecules.
I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought because I have to rudely interrupt.
All right.
And so we'll go back to this integration idea in a second. Everybody stay with us. We have to take this short break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about using biology, little biological, like viruses and cells and things like that, biology to create electronic parts, possibly to make transistors and computers and memory, and also to use things like DNA to program. And if you want to talk about that, you're welcome to join us at number 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Angela Belcher of MIT, Arisa Vaughn of the Technion, it's Israeli Institute of Technology, and Eric Winfrey of Caltech. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted my guest, Arisa Vaughn, he was telling us about, I wanted to make a comment. Maybe you want to start over with your thought about where we are, where we stand now.
All right, so let me get back to this integration issue. Because you see, for instance, in what we are doing, we use biology to build some electronic circuit, a functional electronic circuit. However, for real integration, you need to find ways, or I should say invent ways, how to feed back from the electronic functionality back to biology. And this is really a hard thing, because biology generally does not use electronic currents. It uses ionic currents, but does not use electronic currents. So we have to invent all kind of molecular switches and feedback loops that will feed back from something that nature doesn't know at all back to the biology. And I believe that this is the hardest challenge. But it's really crucial to go forward.
So you have to find some sort of hybrid system here that's not quite electronic, not quite biologic?
I think so, yes. I think so that eventually it will have to be hybrid, because electronic circuits have their advantages and biological molecules have their advantages, and we'll have to learn how to create a real interface between the two. At the moment, we are learning how to use biology, a biological process, to assemble electronic devices for us, or this wonderful experiment Angela was doing to use a virus so that it templates growth of all kinds of materials. But to really close the loop, we'll have to invent all kinds of switches, molecular switches, that will judge for electronic functionality and feedback to the biological realm. And that's hard. That's very, very hard.
Angela, you agree this is going to be a little bottleneck here?
I think it depends on what the application is. I think that in the case of, you have wires that are built with biological components. If you just want to make small wires that are connected to each other, you may not need to have the biological component there anymore. And so it could already interface with more traditional kinds of electronics. The same with magnetic materials. If you could just evolve an organism to make a magnetic wire where you don't need the biology anymore, then it could already be functional. In addition, I think one of the things that's really powerful about biology is, say you do have these kinds of problems, well, you can evolve through it. You can give the organism the responsibility and the goal to to select and evolve through that problem. And so where it may be hard to stop and rationally think about how to to solve the problem, we do have the ability to manipulate these molecules and evolution on our side if we can encourage the interactions. So I think that part is definitely challenging, but I look at it much more as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to William in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, William.
Yes, sir. I wanted to ask you about the possibility of using these techniques to assemble, say, for example, in the pancreas, to assemble the efficiently operating insulin-producing cells for people who don't have that, and what's the possibility of doing that? In addition, what about other organs and organ systems about
Good
having
question.
Them bioengineered?
Why not? Yes, let me ask all my guests. Angela, what about if you can use viruses to create these pathways for wires to be put down? Could you do that? Could you not do that in the body to create pathways for nerves that might be broken, or spinal cord injuries, or the pancreas, like he's saying?
That's a very good question, and we have quite a bit of effort in our group right now in that we're trying to take advantage of the fact that these are biological molecules and they're going to be biocompatible. And we're looking at them for functions like nerve regeneration and interfacing with medical implants. And we think that it's a great place to go in looking at these types of biological molecules as platforms and scaffolds for interfacing living cells.
Uri Sivan?
Well, of course, I mean, this is a very promising avenue. For instance, along the way, we have developed ways to self-assemble a conducting wire between basically any sites, biological sites that you can label. So we're trying to apply that, for instance, to connect between two different neurons, to create an electronic connection between them or between other cells and so on. Thus far, I mean, we didn't have much success, but it is certainly a very important direction.
Well, like you say, that nerves don't talk to each other electrically. They talk to, you know, with electric currents on wires, they talk to each other ionically. So
right,
that would be a problem there.
Of course. I mean, it makes things a little bit harder, but, mm-hmm. I mean, the same way that, you know, you can contact them with some electrodes.
Mm-hmm.
In principle, you may dream of creating also some conducting passes.
Eric, you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I come from a background of computer science and mathematics, and to me, medical issues are hard. So, no, I don't.
Okay, let me ask you about some of the DNA work. What other kinds of algorithms are there that DNA can be useful in?
Well, an example of the kind of thing that we're interested in is how do you specify a complex pattern? So one such pattern might be, for example, the circuit layout for some kind of chip, maybe an FPGA uh-huh. chip or Pentium, or maybe just a simple basic circuit like binary multiplication. How do you arrange components into that pattern? How do you specify what the pattern is that you want?
Uh-huh.
One way, of course, is sort of to make a blueprint and say, well, this piece goes here, that piece goes there, and sort of lay it all out in a table. But that kind of specification of the pattern is rather difficult for biological-like processes like self-assembly. You'd rather have a very small number of components that somehow fit together into the right kind of structure. And this is the task that we're looking at, finding a sort of small number of, like I was saying before, jigsaw pieces or arrangements that you can, shapes that molecules can have, in our case DNA, such that the only way they fit together actually leads to building some kind of structure like the layout for a multiplication circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually surprising that mathematically you can show that this purely geometrical process of putting shapes together is what's known in computer science as Turing universal. That is to say, any kind of program that you could write on your electronic computer can, in principle at least, be converted to a set of shapes that fit together in such a way as to reproduce the same information processing or produce the same result.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you have a very small program that is a specification for how to build a multiplication circuit, you can translate that potentially into a set of geometrical shapes and then into a set of molecules that self-assemble into the same structure.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Chris in Indianapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm wondering, and this may be for Eric, the gentleman with the computer science degree, but I'm wondering how you communicate with these viruses or these biologic things being used. Is it comparable to like a binary language? Is there Microsoft Windows for biologists? You know, I'm kind of curious how you issue commands and tell them what you want them to do.
Well, let me remind everybody that we're talking about computers this hour and biologics used to create them on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me send that to Angela because she works with viruses. Angela, how do you communicate with the virus?
Well, the viruses themselves are the scaffold that has the genetic information that codes for the synthesis of the wire, where the wire actually has many of the same properties as computers have now, except for they're smaller. And so you could initially envision the connections and the communication being not that much different than in your current computer. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be more densely packed and smaller, and that it will be able to self-assemble itself. Mm-hmm. I think that looking at other kinds of information processing, like the one that Eric looks at, has a different format.
Mm-hmm. And so you basically, with your virus work, you find and you breed a population of viruses that will interact with some kind of metal. Let's say it's zinc or something like that. And you find viruses that like to grab onto this metal, and then you breed them, find those, and then you sort of engineer them to grab onto other kinds of metals and substrates that you would find on a computer chip. And when they then lie down and form the backbone, and then you sort of give them a solution of metallic salts that they grow as a crystal onto that backbone, and you don't need the virus anymore in certain cases because you've got now the metallic pathways. Is that correct? Would I be describing that correctly?
That's exactly correct. The one of the nice things about the virus is that it actually is a perfect template. It's evolved naturally to be a perfect template, and we're just connecting a different kind of material to it. And it's one thing that's really interesting about it. It's just not binding a single kind of metal. It's binding different metals or different atoms in a complex way and growing it from the ground up. So it's a way of synthesizing a material. It could be a wire from the ground up,
right?
Based on selection and evolution. And then you put in the solution, you keep allowing them to grow and to form this single crystal wire, and then you can just increase the temperature and burn off the biological component, but you've already engineered it to go where you want it to be.
Right.
And so now you have a connection that that was all based on self-assembly and molecular recognition.
Now, Yuri Sivan, you've created transistors that are able to be assembled out of DNA, that know how to put the carbon nanotubes together. And where do you go from here? What is your next step? What would you like to achieve?
All right. So, our challenge is to go into more and more complex structures. Now, not necessarily even electronics. I mean, we are interested very much in electronics, but I think that generally nanotechnology, I mean, the crux of the matter is whether we'll be able to invent ways to self-assemble large amount of objects into something functional. So we are very much interested in complexity. And to us, it seems that really to go to something complex, one has to invent those feedback loops that I was mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
You can do with just self-assembly, the way we are doing, you can go to certain complexity. But to go beyond that complexity, you must judge at each step whether you assembled the right stuff you wanted to assemble, either just geometrically or functionally. Now, to judge that, you need some kind of feedback loop. You need to judge that the function was really achieved. And biology does it all the time. As I was saying, I mean, we don't have such a mechanism to judge from electronic functionality.
So you'll need that you need to develop. All right, I don't mean to interrupt, but we run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests. Yuri Sivan is professor in the Department of Physics at the Technion Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa. I want to thank you for staying up late and talking with us, and Shabbat Shalom to you. Angela Belcher is John Chipman, Associate Professor of Material Science at the MIT in Cambridge, and Eric Winfrey, Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Computation and Neural Science Systems at Caltech in Pasadena. Thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. And Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. You can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have Science Friday's Kids Connection up there, where you free curricula for students and teachers. Also, back editions of Science Friday on Real Audio and Audible.com formats. Also, please, again, we're going to be in New York in 2 weeks. Come see us. We're going to be broadcasting from the CUNY Graduate Center on Fifth Avenue, and that's on January 23rd. You're invited. Check out our website for details. We'd love to see you in our audience. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.